I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Tim Beatley from the University of Virginia to Fremantle Shipping News. Welcome, Tim.
Oh, thank you.
Tim, you're no stranger to Australia or Western Australia or, for that matter, to Fremantle. Tell me, and all of our readers and listeners, a little bit of your background and how it is that you come to be here at this point.
Well, it's a longer story, I guess, but I'm teach at the University of Virginia. I'm a professor of urban and environmental planning, and I've taught there for about 30 years. A lot of it focused on how we can incorporate nature into cities and environmental planning and policy. Those are mainly what I teach. And in that orbit, got to know Peter Newman, Professor Peter Newman, who invited me here. I think that's how I came originally. It was a sabbatical year for me in 2005. And Peter's been to Charlottesville, Virginia. We've done a lot of work together, and that's been my main connection to Fremantle. But I think this is now my fourth time here. So,
well, welcome back, I should
say. Yeah, so, and they're, unfortunately, they're never very long visits. The first one was 4 months, which was enough time to kind of get to know the city. But it's a wonderful place.
So where are you staying these days? What part of Fremantle are you in?
Well, we're here in South Frio, and this visit, the house in Thomas Street, and not far from where we started in 2005 on Chester. So we've gotten to know this particular part of the city fairly well.
And what's your take on Fremantle?
Well, I love Fremantle. Fremantle has a wonderful spirit to it, and it's a place we've just talking about the South Fremantle in particular, where we've been living, is just wonderful for its organic nature. The houses, each house seems to be its own individual creation, and homeowners who've done interesting, funny things to their homes and built them and added to them over time. We just love it. It's one of my favorite places to walk, and of course the nature is part of that as well, and it's trees and birds and all of that, something very special about the kind of organic mix of built things and environment.
Well, that's a good introduction to come to some of your work. You talked about cities, nature, more recently you've written about oceans, the water. What is it that you're trying to convey and have conveyed through your research and your writing? What is it that you're trying to remediate, if you like, in terms of human existence or anything else that goes in that direction?
Yeah. Well, we talk a lot about the concept of biophilia, this notion. I have to give a lot of credit to Professor Ed Wilson, E.O. Wilson from Harvard, who wasn't the first person to use the term, but he's kind of popularized it in the way we think of it. This idea that we have an affiliation, we have an innate connection to nature, that we're drawn to nature, that we it's not something optional in our lives, we argue. It's something absolutely essential to leading a happy and healthy and meaningful life. So we've just, you know, been in cities and in buildings, a tiny little bit of our evolutionary history. So we have that need to have contact with the natural environment. But at the same time, we have cities and my field of urban planning and sustainable cities. We're trying to design denser, more compact, more sustainable cities. So the challenge is, how can you have that compactness, that density, those urban qualities, but also still have those connections to nature? And so that's the core challenge for us, and we've been promoting this idea of biophilic cities that are sustainable and resilient and compact and all those things that we want from an urban planning and sustainability point of view, but also foster and incorporate connections to nature in every place possible.
Now, you come to a place like Fremantle, and there are no doubt many equivalent places around the world where you have a have an older urban setting, and it might be that you don't see too many trees, you mightn't see too much nature as you would ordinarily think of it. Can you successfully adapt those places? And the related question is, can you design new cities? I'm thinking about the modern Chinese cities that yeah. you now see, for example, which reflect the biophilic imperatives.
You can. You can retrofit existing urban environments, to be sure, and we certainly can incorporate nature when we're building new things in the city and when cities are growing. So my first answer is to talk about how the biophilic challenge applies to different scales. So we, in biophilic cities, we argue that it's a multi-scale, that it's a whole of city vision. So that means that we want nature all around us where we're living and working, including the interior spaces of those environments. And then at the other end, the regional or bioregional scale, and here that means ocean and bushland that might be, you know, a bit of a distance away from where you live, but every scale in between. So room to region or rooftop to region, again, everywhere else, though, the spaces around your home or your work, the block, the neighborhood, the city, the region. So it's there are opportunities for incorporating nature in all of those places. So increasingly we're imagining cities that provide a kind of immersion in nature. So one of our partner cities in our biophilic cities network is Singapore. And Singapore is an example. Singapore has changed the motto of their city from Singapore Garden City to Singapore, a city in a garden. So this idea that we don't just need to go to the park, go to find nature by going to the park down the road or going to the garden or the little bit of bushland, you know, at the end of the road. We ought to be living in the garden. We ought to be living. We ought to see ourselves as living in the park. So that's the kind of vision of a biophilic city that we're seeing cities embrace.
Now, you mentioned at the outset where this concept might be said to have come from in more modern times, perhaps satisfying some deep part of our DNA in practical terms, being a human being living on the planet or living in one of these cities. What is it to do for us? What does it do for us?
It does a lot for us, and it's remarkable the amount of evidence that's coming out almost daily, it seems like, but especially in the last 5 years, we've had just an abundance of research about this, and not surprising that we are calmer, our blood pressure goes down, our mood is changes in a positive way when we have nature around us. The Japanese have done all of this work around so-called forest bathing, this idea of walking through a forest. And at the end of that walk, they have a lot of research that shows that your stress hormone levels go down. That walk boosts your immune system. So there are many physical and mental health benefits associated with having that nature around you. But beyond that, I would say that we want to live in a place where we have other forms of life around us. There is an important role to play, nature plays in terms of fostering a sense of awe, a sense of wonder. A biophilic city is a city that cultivates a curiosity about the nature around us, back to that meaningful life, and we are seeking meaning in our lives. Many of us, most of us, nature, I think, must be a big part of that human journey.
Now, are there any model cities in the early days of the 20th century, late 19th century, the garden city was considered, the garden suburb was considered to be a model for future existence? Are there places, are there cities that reflect in a fairly comprehensive way what you've just been describing?
Well, there are no perfect examples. And I think one thing to say about a biophilic city is the way it manifests and the the practices, the policies, the kind of nature that you can incorporate into that city will vary depending on where you are, of course, depending on the climate and the ecology and the location of that city. So we've been working with Phoenix, Arizona, as an example. There, very hot, desert environment. Green rooftops don't work very well in Phoenix.
I only know that area from Breaking Bad.
Okay, well, it's a challenging area in some ways. If you're trying to promote a contact with nature and it's 120 degrees Fahrenheit outside, understandably people want to be in an air conditioned room. So there's some challenges in cities like that, but on the other hand, it's a wonderful nature, and they have some very large desert parks there, and now the city of Phoenix is bringing that desert nature, that desert vegetation into the city, so cacti, mesquite trees, low water, xeriscaped vegetation that makes a lot of sense from a sustainability and water conservation point of view and energy conservation point of view, but also provides that connection to nature for urbanites there. So to answer your question, there's no perfect city. There are a number of cities, many of them now in our BioFlix Cities network, like Singapore,
yes,
that are exemplary. And a city like Singapore may be the closest thing that we have to a nature immersive city, consistent with the vision of what a BioFlix City could be.
Something that's become quite famous, in fact, Fremantle Shipping News has alluded to in an earlier article, is the High Line in Manhattan, which has taken some very industrial place and turned it into almost a, not quite a forest, but in Manhattan's terms, something like that.
Yeah. Well, High Line is a wonderful story, and New York would be another really positive example of a city that's done wonderful things in the last decade, especially to promote that connection with nature. The High Line is an example. A lot of other cities that have been inspired by the High Line and are doing some version of that. New York is, we haven't talked much about the blue side to this.
Tell me about the blue.
Yeah, well, I just started to suggest that New York is interesting because of the new connections to water. I mean, this is a city that is, its motto is the water city, but yet
you wouldn't want to go swimming in it, perhaps.
Well, you wouldn't have wanted to 20 or 30 years ago, and there's still actually billions of gallons of raw sewage that at certain times go into the New York Harbor. They still have some problems, but the water's a lot cleaner than it used to be, and that's true for many cities, and that's part of the renaissance or the reconnecting to the New York Harbor and to water more generally, and it's been wonderful to see that. So new waterfront parks in that city, new opportunities to actually physically access the water, to be on the water. They've just unveiled a new ferry service, expanding their ferries in New York. It's going back in many ways to that kind of harbor water culture that existed years ago.
Now, without going into all of the deep roots of where modern environmental policy has come from, you sort of evoke Rachel Carson's Silent Spring when you start thinking about dirty waterways and the rejuvenation of Manhattan itself, and Jane Jacobs' book, which was in some ways an apex of that urban regeneration debate. But here we are with visions that you are providing now. How do you implement? How do you achieve? Do you mandate policies through mm-hmm. state and local government laws? How do you do this?
Mm-hmm. You do all of that. I think that there are many points of leverage, and in cities like Singapore and New York, there are private sector actors that are pushing the envelope So it's been interesting to see. Singapore has a policy called the landscape replacement policy, so that when you build a new building there, you are required to at least replace the nature lost at the ground level with nature in the vertical realm. So that means, you know, green rooftops and sky gardens, and they've innovated all of these, even a typology of different forms of vertical greening and vertical nature, which is really impressive. And if you look at the advertisements, real estate company flat, you know, advertising flats, that nature, those nature elements are really prominent. So there's kind of a very interesting friendly competition between developers to see which building can go the furthest in implementing this idea. So that's the private sector, aided by public sector policies, the landscape replacement policy, also federal or in, city and national subsidies often, certainly for Singapore. So when you build that green roof or that green wall, a part of that will be paid for by the government. So it's a set of interlocking, reinforcing policies, regulations, and financial incentives, mm-hmm. And the power also of just the vision and the kinds of benefits we've been talking about today that are not lost on, for example, office on companies and who are interested in creating work environments where worker productivity is higher.
It becomes the accepted community ethic.
It does. It can be. Yeah.
Take Fremantle then and start to translate, just looking at what you see now, these policies, both the green and the blue to which you've referred, the nature and including the water, which we are not quite surrounded by here, but it's adjacent and all near us. What has Fremantle achieved, do you think, when you apply any sort of measure against it in these terms? What more can we do, do you imagine? What in, say, 20 years' time, when you're coming back for the seventh or eighth time, might you see?
Yeah, I think there are so many biophilic qualities already present in Fremantle, and I'm certainly not an expert on the development code or the development plan, the vision for the city. You've got an older city and a kind of higher density core, a lot of more suburban, where we are here in South Fremantle, it's largely single family, but lots of trees and greenery and nature and birds and a wonderful kind of organic environment. I'm not sure there's that much to do.
There's lots of but parks. And
lots light. Of parks. Mm-hmm. And I think we just have to look for opportunities at every turn. So when the city is building something new, or when a developer is building something new in the city, a multi-story building is a great opportunity for a bushland on the top or a green wall. Remarkable stories of cities that are putting, you know, planting trees in funny places that may not seem as obvious, and high-rise buildings that are wrapped now in trees. So this idea of a vertical forest, all of those things, which the city has done to some degree. I know there was an experimental Greenskins project that involved installing green walls on city buildings here. I think just looking for those opportunities to incorporate nature into the core of the city, and judging success based on some of those metrics of what is the tree canopy coverage, for example, in the city. I don't know what it is. It'd be very high, probably, here in South Fremantle. So the connections to water, you already have a lot of that, of course. And this concept of blue urbanism is really...
Tell us more about this blue urbanism. What does that really mean?
Yeah, and it's an emerging idea, and I must say that even though we use the terminology a lot, blue, connecting the urban and the blue, it's still remains to be seen. And I can, you know,
well, there's many impediments. For
many impediments.
If you're in Perth, you know, people famously go to Cottesloe Beach. Here, we walk down to South Beach. There's Bathers Beach. There's Leighton and Port. There's places that are quite accessible. Yeah. Is it something more than being able to dip your toe in the water and not be taken by a shark?
It is, in fact, and again, it's an open discussion. Part of what I've been trying to do is start that discussion. If we live on the blue planet, and this is sort of how it started for me as an urban planner, it's the blue planet. More than 70% of our our area is
it's
in
water. It's so beautiful to look at.
And you're right here on the perched on the Indian Ocean and a very blue context. And we're increasingly the urbanized planet, but yet we don't often connect those two things, as two kind of profound circumstances of planet Earth at the moment. So partly this is about physical connections to oceans. It's looking for opportunities. I mentioned New York City, the idea of parks now that extend into the water and along the water, and providing opportunities at any place we can to allow residents to see marine life. They have a direct connection with that marine environment. It's programmatic as well as physical design. So in cities like Seattle, we have a number of examples of cities that have been doing things to promote awareness about marine life. So there are low tide walks, special opportunities to see marine life that might require a little help from a guide or a marine docent who could help you understand what that is that you're seeing. There are, of course, many opportunities to actually be in the water or on the water, and we have cities like Boston where they've helped to get people on sailboats and making that possible. There's a community sailing, a club that for $1, you can have access to sailboats. I mean, it's a little bit more to it than that, but
things that people have forgotten how to do.
Yeah,
in a sense.
And all those things that we have been doing to improve water quality. New York is an interesting example. Humpback whales are starting to come back into New York Harbor, and their whale watching tours, and there are their people are starting to pay more attention to what's happening in the harbor, and this is not unusual. And
Moby Dick will make a comeback in college literature
courses. And dolphins are coming along as well, and seals and other. So as we improve the health of those harbor environments, there are a lot of opportunities for that, for those kinds of connections to that marine world. We have examples, actually. We did some filming just outside Seattle of a very interesting program called Peer Into the Night, where it's a place called Gig Harbor, where they set up a camera. They actually set up a screen on a pier. And it's a public event, and they have volunteer divers who go into the water, and they have little GoPro cameras, and they broadcast or they send back images of what they're finding underwater. And people, families are huddled around these screens just in awe of what they're... So part of this is to foster that emotional connection to the marine world and a sense of caring, we hope, that will emerge from that as well. So there are probably 1,001 ways that we could foster, we could connect the city with the ocean.
Now, what are the obstacles to this happening? I imagine, to some extent, they're philosophical or political or economic, but there might also be very practical ones. Can you make the trees stay alive when you put them on rooftops and the like? What are the difficulties in achieving the vision?
Well, there are certainly those kinds of design and technical sort of considerations. I mean, we've gotten better at figuring them out. So there are these twin towers in Milan that are wrapped with trees, and they, you know, they've chosen the trees, they've sized the the structures that hold the trees. They've got a watering system. It's entirely possible. So, and a lot of the things that we used to do, we still do things like green roofs that were 20 or 30 years ago, kind of more experimental, are now off the shelf. They don't leak anymore, for example, and a lot of the sort of perceived problems have been solved. There is the issue of cost, definitely, and with many green features on buildings, there's an additional upfront cost associated with that natureful element. But what we're finding is that with a green roof, for example, that it quickly pays for itself, and there are many positive economic benefits associated with that investment in a green roof. So it for example, protects the underlying roof, and you don't have to replace it as frequently. For instance, there are energy conservation and other values in green walls. Similarly, so with almost everything that we're talking about, the short-term economic cost is more than compensated for by the longer-term benefits, economic benefits and other benefits flowing from them.
When it comes to people's residences, their homes, are there sort of ideal outcomes that one seeks to achieve?
Well, I guess that depends on what kind of a home. Is it a single family detached? Is it a single family attached? A duplex? Flat? A block of flats? Is it a unit in a 30 or 40 story building? And the answer is there are things that you can do in all of those settings. And again, back to the vertical ideas, we have systems now for growing food on balconies and a lot of opportunities to bring nature inside. So I think we may perceive that it's easiest to do things in that single family, context where you have a backyard, a front yard, you have space around your house. And that certainly is a kind of no-brainer. We should be doing, we should be greening and incorporating as much nature in those places as we can.
So achieving that sort of individual set of outcomes, is that simply reliant on, if you like, broad movements and individuals acting to achieve the outcomes, or are you able to prescribe the courses of conduct, get you into sort of again questions of philosophy and politics. How do these things best happen in your experience?
Right. Well, I think it's a combination of philosophy and vision and the tools that can implement or advance those visions and that philosophy. So, in every city that I can think of that represents a good example, it's a sort of dynamic mix. So I do describe the biophilic cities as a global movement. So there are a lot of individuals and non-governmental groups, organizations that are advocating for this vision, and they're pushing and doing often. And so in our world and in our partner cities in the Biophilic Cities Project, there are groups like a group called BioPhilly in Philadelphia that's been an advocacy organization, and they hold conferences and they advise, they're agitating for more nature in the city. Similarly, a group called BioPhilic DC in Washington, and in fact the group that kind of got the city council to adopt the Biophilic Cities resolution and to join our network. So there are a lot of things that can happen at that level, and I mentioned the development community doing a lot of things on their own. But it also requires government and the public sector to be involved. Again, laying those basic codes, those basic requirements, the whole concept of biophilic codes is an interesting thing. So we have a number of cities that have adopted some form of green area ratio requirements, sort of like the landscape replacement policy in Singapore. We want a certain, we want you to achieve a certain amount of nature on site, on a building site, but it's up to you to figure out what combination of things will reach that threshold. So some flexibility, but still setting a standard. Or a tree protection ordinance or a stormwater code. There's so many ways that we can actually, from the public sector, we can go beyond just simply a pilot project and actually amplify and extend throughout the city these green ideas.
Is the garnering of community support, both public sector, private sector, business, individual actors, aided by demonstrating or driven by demonstrating the economic advantages of going down these ways?
It is. Definitely those arguments have a lot of power and help to convince elected officials about this. It's certainly true in Philadelphia and Washington, New York, places where we've been working. A few years ago, a company called Terrapin Bright Green produced a really interesting report on the economics of biophilia, and they did some back of the envelope calculations about, you know, if you greened every school, if you incorporated nature into schools, what would that mean in terms of improving test scores and improving attendance, and what would greening and tree planting mean for crime reduction? We have a lot of evidence about that, for instance.
It seems to be exactly the sort of thing you want to know more about. That's more diffuse. That's harder to put a number on, but people are putting numbers on these things.
Yes.
So what you're really talking about, are you, is the regeneration of communities in many respects, making them viable, making them real networks of individuals.
You are, and I'm slightly suspicious of too much emphasis on the economic argument. It can carry the day and can be very compelling to a mayor or an elected official, but we tend to want to emphasize the improvements in quality of life and the mental and physical health benefits and the improvements in relationships between human beings. We have a lot of evidence that when you have natureful environments, that fosters, you know, better connection to people, to each other. There's actually some evidence that shows that in the presence of nature, we're more likely to be generous. We're more likely to be cooperative. Some evidence from
a breakout of goodness.
Yeah, well, I think nature. It's not a surprise when we think about the evolutionary history of our species that we're more comfortable, happiest, perhaps more generous when we have nature around us. So nature helps us to be better human beings in many ways. So that's an argument more from the community and interpersonal dimension, and so I have a lot of evidence about how nature can bring us together, and examples of how deep friendships have been formed, and communities have brought a level of cohesion and care about as a result of having as a result of some concern about nature. So.
Well, Tim, we've almost brought the conversation full circle to how this wondrous area of teaching and research, and obviously a passion of yours, this whole biophilic cities movement, came to be and where we're at. Let me ask you this, are there some particular products of this in real life that absolutely take your breath away? Have you seen things that you think, my goodness, that I could never believe that could have happened? This represents the Biophilic Cities movement in wonderful ways. You know, people go off to see the architecture of Gaudi in Barcelona. You've just described the Twin Towers project in Milan. That might fit in it. But
those are pretty remarkable projects and stories that I wouldn't have necessarily expected to see 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And so what's interesting is that almost every part of the world and almost every city has multiple stories like this. And you mentioned the High Line, and when the High Line came along, that was just, we all had this epiphany that, wow, you could have, you could convert, you know, a former elevated rail line into a linear park, and it's now next to Central Park. It's, you know, the place people want to go. And now they're talking about, there's a remarkable design for something called the Spiral Tower, which will be right across the street from where the High Line ends. And they're talking about extending the High Line through a series of exterior stairs, so that you'll have a kind of vertical garden wrapping around the spiral building. Just remarkable things like that, or the Trans Bay Transit Center in San Francisco. This is a transit center, but on the roof of this building is going to be this immense park. So this whole reimagining of the kind of vertical nature of cities as places for nature is something we could imagine it, and we certainly had a lot of people, you know, draw it and speculate about it, but to see it all happening in this way is pretty remarkable.
Well, I'm assuming that every architecture course these days is integrating this type of thinking into it.
Well, you'd hope so, but unfortunately not, I'm afraid. And in fact, sometimes architects are a little fearful of this agenda. And I think sometimes the greening of buildings offends some of the purest architectural style.
They
want clean lines and you know, smooth surfaces, and there's a kind of modernist architecture orientation that many architects don't often find room for nature in those. We had an interview with Richard Hassel, who is part of WOHA Architects, building. They're designing some of the neatest buildings in Singapore, as well as other parts of Australia. And actually, Richard is a Western Australian. In fact, he's from here, and he told me in an interview we actually interviewed him about one particular building that we are quite impressed by, which is the Park Royal Hotel, relatively new hotel. It's just draped in greenery, a series of sky gardens and people who stay at that hotel have, you know, rooms with views of nature. It's just a remarkable building. And he told me that some of the architectural community didn't react very favorably to this building because it's messy. It's got draping, flowing nature, and it looks more like a forest than a conventional building in some ways. So I think that we have a little work to do. I'm not sure we're teaching biophilic design principles in most schools of architecture, I'm afraid.
Well, perhaps in a relatively few short years, on one of your next visits to Fremantle, it will be draped in greenery.
Maybe. That's good. I hope so. Well, it already is to a large degree.
It is to a large degree, as you say, and we're surrounded by the water. Tim, thank you for explaining these green and blue visions of yours and thank you for thinking about Fremantle and commenting on how it fits into all of this. And the best of luck with the rest of your stay here.
Thank you.
Thank you for talking to us again.
Thank you.